On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes, subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we'll be talking about the incredible phenomenon that is metamorphosis in insects and animals. Some really incredible stories about the animal kingdom in that. You will really enjoy it. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of them in the podcast. All right. It's time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from DCU, the Honourable Dr. Susan Kelleher. Well, you're both very welcome. Shane, our first story has to do with an unbreakable law. And this is work coming from Trinity.
Absolutely. From our friends in Trinity College, Dublin. So biologists talk about something called a thermal performance curve, right? So basically, for living systems, performance tends to increase gradually as temperature rises for the system. And then it reaches an optimum point, and after that, kind of performance falls off. So what am I talking about?
What are you talking about?
Things like the rate at which a bacteria might divide, muscle performance, basic physiological and ecological performances that they tend to
have. So not just individual animals, but also processes within these living animals.
Absolutely. So things at a more kind of biochemical level. So the fundamental chemistry of what's going on in the living system. But what the people at Trinity have done in a very interesting paper that's been published in PNAS is that they've said that there's a universality to this, right? So there's a single consistent mathematical pattern describing this trend for all living systems. So they looked at 2,500 thermal performance curves from several kingdoms and accounting for a whopping 2,500 individual experiments. And they found that all species share the same underlying curve. So whether you are bacteria or you're a lizard with muscles, that you're all going to kind of fit to this mathematical curve. Now, the shape of the curve is universal, but the various temperature optima are different depending on the species. So a bacteria seems to be happiest at around 100 degrees Celsius for dividing, which I thought was rather high. And fish seem to be happiest at around 25 degrees Celsius, which maybe that's why lots of them live in tropical oceans. So the shape of the curve remains the same. It's just stretched and shifted depending on the species that matters. And what they're saying is that this is really important because it's an evolutionary shackle, as it were, right? You can't break out of this performance curve. So in other words, things had to evolve within it. And of course, there is the perennial issue that once we start changing the environmental temperatures of where different species are, due to climate change, that we may be affecting the efficiency of various basic physiological functions in all species that we're aware of.
Yeah, but the external temperature doesn't always have an effect on a system temperature, right? I'm always drawn back to this incredible homeostasis, the sort of balance that we have inside our bodies that keeps our core temperature at 37.5 degrees, 37-ish degrees. And that whether you are a fireman going to rescue a baby in an inferno or you are in the Arctic tundra, your core temperature really doesn't vary by more than 0.5 of a degree, which I think is extraordinary. So is it fair to say that climate change necessarily will put pressure on species if we have that level of adaptability to outside temperature on a species level?
You're right that we have the capacity to thermoregulate as mammals, right? But the difference in temperature between our core and the environment in which we're existing matters, right? So basic thermodynamics comes into play here. You'll only survive...
He's trying to add physics me here, Susan.
I'm worried about Susan being a chemist and her correcting my my basic thermodynamics. But if you're in an extreme environment temperature wise, you have to do more work in your body to keep your core temperature level. And there's only a certain degree of variance that you're able to survive. You wouldn't survive long in an oven, or indeed in the Antarctic.
That's why we have frostbite, and our bits start falling off because our body is desperately trying to keep us warm and says, we don't need these fingers anymore. All we need to survive is the brain and the heart and the testes or the eggs. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So I absolutely take that point. But that's really interesting. We didn't know about this sort of biological, mathematical constant that exists across all animals before. That's a pretty big discovery, isn't it?
It is. Now, I would caveat, physicists wouldn't describe this as a law or anything like that. But from a biological point of view, there is a degree of universality that this paper has suggested. And that's very, very cool, because we now know an awful lot more about every living system.
Susan, gluten. Where are we at with gluten? Because the new paper says gluten may not be as problematic as we thought. Is that what it actually says?
Good question, and very important to distinguish between celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. And that's what this paper is looking at. So celiac disease, still, you know, a horrendous disorder where you've got inflammation of the gut and you've got this attacking of the inner lining of the gut when a person who has celiac disease eats the protein gluten. So that's not what this is looking at, but this is looking at what's called non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So this is self-reported in around 10% of people that say that they have a sensitivity to gluten when they eat bread or when they eat pasta, etc. And the sensitivity includes sort of fatigue or bloating or stomach pain. And this paper, which was published this week in The Lancet, it reports on work done from the University of Melbourne, where they got people who have suffered from this non-celiac gluten sensitivity into the lab, and they gave them a variety of different foods and a variety of different things, and they didn't know necessarily what they were eating.
Right.
And what they saw is that about 80% of the people had similar response, whether there was gluten there or not. So from placebos, and then also sort of another type of protein that can cause inflammation that's not gluten, and then actually gluten being there as well. So there was no great distinction between the effect of gluten versus, say, a placebo. It is just with people with this sensitivity, not necessarily celiac disease. It was around trying to understand where this large percentage of people who are sensitive to gluten comes from. Not necessarily gluten that they think is causing the effect, which is really interesting, because a lot of the time, if you have these symptoms, a practitioner might just say, you know, just forgo gluten. And it's very challenging. People with celiac disease have to do that anyway, and even the tiniest bit of gluten will throw it off completely. But it's a hard thing for someone who has this gluten sensitivity to, you know, have to avoid and then have these effects if they don't, especially if it's not gluten that might be causing it.
So what you're saying is that the number of people who said they had gluten sensitivity but weren't medically diagnosed with celiac disease, that when they were exposed to gluten in their diet, they didn't seem to have any of the symptoms you would ordinarily associate with someone who did have a sensitivity to gluten.
Sorry, they still had effects, but the effects were there if they had a placebo. So it's not that they had no effects, but if they were given something that they were told had gluten in it and it didn't, they still had effects. So they think there's a lot of maybe sort of psychological things or other types of proteins as well causing effects, not just gluten.
Yeah, but wouldn't you get that with a lot of drugs that also work? But they're saying the difference between placebo and was minimal, that basically it is an entirely placebo effect.
I think they also looked at, so there was proteins that were gluten, there were food items that were gluten containing, then there were food items that had other types of proteins in them, and they had some that had no proteins known to have this effect, and they saw similar symptoms being diagnosed in people who had this sensitivity. And they hypothesize in the paper that it could be, while they very much the symptoms are there, they do propose, is there some psychosomatic element to, you know, the essentially that idea that if you think you're going to be unwell from this, it might spur it on, etc. But there are, like, I suppose maybe it's just more complicated that I'm sensitive to gluten, because there could be other proteins as well that are interacting with the gut or with the stomach.
And I suppose, you know, a lot of people tend to really embrace it and make it a part of their identity. And God, it's such a hard thing to do. You know, one of the symptoms, you know, it seems also to be having to tell everybody about it when you have it. But so I'm sure they will absolutely not love this paper that seems to claim that a lot of it is in is a placebo effect. But
like IBS is a, like, irritable bowel syndrome is a legitimate syndrome, but there's a lot of other ways. Sort of, they do base on like CBT based diagnosis, as in like just trying to think about food in a different way. Symptoms are symptoms. People, we know that people don't feel well when they eat things, you know, and that's totally fine. But it's around, maybe you don't have to totally avoid gluten in the way the celiacs do.
Yeah.
So maybe there's hope there, you know?
No, I mean, God, I mean, what a horrible thing to have to do to yourself to restrict gluten. You know, I couldn't live without it, I have to say. Shane, men need to exercise more to get the same heart benefits as women.
Not just more, but twice as more, which, I don't know about you. So the NHS, this study was conducted on the UK Biobank project, which is whopper, right? We've spoken about it many times. They collect data on hundreds of thousands of people over time, and they're able to tell the effects of things. So what they looked at here is the effect of, if you do the NHS mandated amount of exercise, which is 35 minutes a day or 150 minutes a week, there is for the 80,000 people that they followed who didn't have coronary heart disease, they found that if you did the 150 minutes mandated by the NHS of exercise a week, which is 35 minutes a day, that women had a 22% lower risk of developing heart disease over 8 years. So they followed people for 8 years and they looked and see, did they get heart disease over that 8 years? And if you were doing 150 minutes of a workout a week, your chances of getting heart disease were 22% lower than people who didn't do the exercise. They found that for men, the drop was only 17%. They found that if women were able to do 250 minutes of exercise a week, that the reduction, the likelihood of them getting coronary heart disease, dropped by a whopping 30% over the following 8 years. But for men to get that same 30% effect, they had to do 530 minutes of exercise a week, which equates to 1.3 hours a day of moderate exercise to get the same effect, which, I don't know about you, that, like, no one has time for that.
Yeah, so that's a lot.
One cool thing, though, that they did find was that for the 5,000 people who they followed who do have coronary heart disease, the risk of dying over the following 8 years was three times lower for women than men, for those who did 150 minutes of exercise a week. So if you do a 30-minute walk every day, women were three times less likely to have died over the eight-year period than their male counterparts, and they don't know why. They really just don't know why. So the stats are there, but they have no mechanism proposed. So we can now open the floor to wild speculation.
You've really hoisted my petard there. I mean, over a large cohort, that should relatively even out the amount of people who overdo it. But the question I have is, why do men die earlier? And I presume a heart attack is a large part of it. So this is clearly a better performance of a woman's heart. I mean, part of it would suggest that most women are smaller. Their heart doesn't have to pump blood as far, and depending on how big a man might be, it's a harder work. I don't know if that's this is wild speculation there now, but you've taken all the fun out of it, Shane. You've taken all the fun out of it. Yeah. Oh, we interviewed the people behind the biobank. I think it's an extraordinary treasure trove of useful data. Our final story has to do with onion tears. So crying when you cut onions. So as a chemist, I thought you might explain why we cry, and then you might explain how to stop us crying, please.
Yeah, no problem. So what's really interesting is onions, as they exist in your fridge right now, the chemical that actually hurts your eyes isn't in the onion. So it is only formed when the cell of the onion is broken. So the molecule is called propane thiol S oxide. And that's this volatile chemical that comes up to your eyes, reacts with water and makes a load of acid. And that's what stings your eyes. But it's not actually in onions. It's only created in onions when cells are burst and an enzyme reacts with another type of sulfur containing compound in the cell to make this volatile compound. So that's the first thing.
Like, so in the closed cell that doesn't burst, it doesn't exist. It's not dangerous. It's only a chemical reaction happens once it's exposed to oxygen.
It opens, yes, exactly. Symptoms that people try to stop, you know, their eyes from hurting include cooling down the onions because that might stop the volatility of this thing. I don't think that's particularly good. Washing, you know, having a running tap so that the running tap will bring the volatile compound towards it rather than towards your eyes, etc. Goggles, you've heard that one before. But this is a study that's come out of Cornell University. And someone, researchers there had a question. It's published this week in PNAS as well. And they had the question of, could it be the way that the knife is cutting the onions? So they started just cutting physically with a knife, a few onions with a high powered camera, with a fast camera. And it turns out, yes. So they got a load of more onions and they made a small guillotine that could cut onions with different blades of different thicknesses, different levels of serration on them and at different speeds. And what they found was when you cut an onion in a messy way, so with a blunt knife or something that's serrated, or if you do it really, really quickly, then the amount of droplets that were released were far greater. And they traveled up to 40 meters, which is amazing. Once that's up there, it's gone near your face. So the tip that they have is cut slowly and cut with a sharp knife. And don't have a serrated edge anywhere near your onion if you want to give yourself the best chance of not crying. Or if you do, of course, want to clear the room of annoying family members, then you know what to do.
Dr. Susan Gallagher from DCU and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thank you very much. It's one of nature's greatest magic tricks and one of its deepest riddles. How does a caterpillar turn into a butterfly? Well, it's metamorphosis, of course. It is a fascinating subject that is documented by Oren Harman in his new book, Metamorphosis. He joins us now. Oren, I have to say, I'm going to be honest, it's embarrassing to admit. I never fully realized the magic of how a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. I always thought that the caterpillar sort of, you know, made this cocoon and then inside its legs grew longer and wings grew out of the body. And it was a change rather than a complete and utter obliteration and regeneration. And it's an extraordinarily crazy thing to do. Maybe you might tell the listeners exactly what happens and how a caterpillar becomes a butterfly, please.
Okay, so it is true. Metamorphosis is wild. And most of us think of tadpoles and frogs and caterpillars and butterflies when we think of metamorphosis, which are sort of quaint thoughts that are often related to childhood and that seem idiosyncratic. But the thing about metamorphosis is that it's both idiosyncratic and almost universal. So biologists estimate that 3/4 of all animal species undergo some form of it, which is really an extraordinary figure. And in the case of the butterfly, a caterpillar will start out life like all the rest of us, namely as an egg, and then it'll hatch as a caterpillar. It will eat and will grow. It will often grow 100 times its original weight, and then it'll disappear into a chrysalis, where it will destroy and rebuild its gut. It will destroy its epidermis. It will grow new structures like wings and legs and sexual parts, and it will rewire its brain entirely. And the question is, how does this happen and why does it happen? Because to turn into a frog, the tadpole has to exchange an aquatic life for terrestrial life. It has to change its diet from leaves and little water bugs to crickets and worms. It has to recut its throat in sync with chest muscles to be able to communicate above ground and also to call out to its mate. It needs to change its immune system because dangers in the water are very different than the ones that lurk on land. It needs to produce the pigments that will invade its skin to make camouflage possible. It needs to absorb its tail, to grow legs that pop out, to destroy and rebuild the gut, the epidermis, to grow the eyes, and to rewire the brain and encase it in a bony cranium. So massive cell death, massive regrowth and developmental reprogramming, and all of this in a matter of weeks. So the question that you put to me is, why and how? And it really is quite a great mystery that we've began to unlock, I'd say, in the last 100 years.
So let's talk about what that means. I mean, why would an animal choose to go through this transformation?
The animal will not choose to go through the transformation.
For sure. No one ever likes that word, but you know what I mean.
Him or her. And that's a very good question. And, you know, the adaptive reasons behind metamorphosis are really the part of metamorphosis which remains mysterious to us in relation to how it actually works, sort of the genetics and the endocrinology of it. But the three main answers to your questions is that, first, metamorphosis will prevent intergenerational competition. So if you think of it this way, you have a caterpillar that eats one thing and is not sexual. And then you have a butterfly which eats a completely other thing, and its entire goal in life is to find a mate. So these two morphs will not compete with one another, and the butterfly will disperse. It will go elsewhere. So you're preventing competition. That's sort of a general answer to the question. But there are other answers as well. So one is I like quite a lot is the idea that when you take apart your gut, when you're turning from a caterpillar into a butterfly, you're actually replacing the parasites in your gut, and you're getting rid of them, and you're replacing your gut fauna. And so an immunological explanation.
Is that a theory, or obviously it's a fact, but is that a theorized benefit from it?
It's a theory. It's a theory. There's evidence to, in its favor. But it's not a clinch theory. It's not a fact in the way that us going around the sun is a fact. But it is something that we're thinking about. Another idea is that there's a sort of trade-off between growth and differentiation. So before you become who you are, it's actually an evolutionary advantage to grow big and strong.
Right. You said 3/4 of all animals undergo metamorphosis. Now, I know insects make up probably a huge part of that. And you mentioned the toad. Are there other types of animals that undergo a metamorphosis that aren't, I suppose, insects or amphibians?
For sure. Almost everything which is an invertebrate underwater in the ocean undergoes metamorphosis. So there are wonderful examples. So let's take the starfish. So again, the starfish starts out life as an egg, and then it develops into a larva, a juvenile form, which sort of looks like a flapping, translucent angel. It has, it's bilateral, and it swims in the ocean.
It doesn't look like a starfish?
Not yet. No. And then, at a certain point in this creature's life, a second developmental program kicks in its tummy and begins to create the star, which is the adult, which then migrates to sort of, the tip of its juvenile. There's a separation. And now the starfish, which is radial in its symmetry and has color and so forth and eats different things entirely, sort of just settles down to the seabed. And what's incredible is that these two morphs coexist. They continue to live simultaneously.
What?
So when you exactly.
Sorry. A single starfish starts off as something translucent and flying or floating in the sea, and then it separates into two separate pieces, one being the starfish and the other being that other thing, and they both continue to live. How is that possible?
Good question. It's really fabulous and fantastic. But if you look at each one of the cells in both of these creatures, each one of the cells has the exact genome inside it. So when we try in our human language to figure out what is this relationship about? So is the juvenile the father of the adult? No. Is it its brother? No. Is it its cousin or its mother? No. They're actually an identity, but they have nothing to do with one another. And if you saw them, you would never guess in a million years that they had anything to do with one another.
Oh, that's crazy. Okay, I'm eating popcorn now. Please tell me some more stories. What else?
Let's go for another sea creature which has an amazing metamorphosis. So this is the sea squirt. So the sea squirt starts out life as a tadpole, and it has a tail, and it just swims about. It looks exactly like a frog tadpole. And then at a certain point in its life, it turns downward, and it latches itself to a rock, and then begins to consume its tail and its brain. And it turns into a tunicate, which is called a tunicate because it looks like a tunic and basically has just two holes in it, one for taking in water and one for blowing them out. So it's an invertebrate now. It was formerly a chordate like you and I, with symmetry, with a front and a back and a top and a bottom. And it's now become one of the most simple invertebrates on the planet that doesn't even have any natural predators because it's so innocuous. And this is the same creature. Again, every cell of these two creatures has the exact same genome in it. So think about it in human terms. This creature has eaten itself up, eaten its legs, eaten its brain, and reverted to a sort of, you know, a lowly invertebrate in order to continue the rest of its life.
And then, so how does it recreate? Because, of course, all animals must regenerate. So how does this creature then create the eggs of its original form?
Right. So that is, so it never returns to its juvenile form, but it then buds its eggs, and its eggs will turn into the juvenile, which will then feed itself again and recreate its adult form.
These are crazy. I can't believe I haven't heard these stories. Absolutely wild.
I'll give you another example. You know, we tend to think of metamorphosis as linear in the sense that there's an egg, there's a larva, and then there's an adult. But in the ocean, there's also a creature called the immortal jellyfish, Turritopsis dornihi, which, when conditions are not great, balls up on itself, sort of eats itself up, and returns to becoming a polyp, which is fastened to the seabed, and then buds its medusa form yet again. And it can do that infinitely.
That's it's amazing. And you know, it's always really refreshing for me when I learn new things about different species. I love those because I've been doing the program for so long. You sort of feel like you've heard every story, but this book is filled with so many of them, and they're absolutely brilliant. If you're interested, the book is called Metamorphosis. The author is Oren Harman. Oren, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan. My pleasure.
That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to producer Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo De Silva, Scott on sound. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. Have a great Sunday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.